Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Friday, May 28th, 2021. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Our first story comes to us from the Des Moines Register. Recent rains help Iowa's farmers, but they do little to drown out drought concerns. Rain, keep coming our way. Aaron Lehman, who grows corn and soybeans near Allman in northern Polk County, has gotten 9 days of measurable rain on his farm in May, but it is still not enough to dampen his concerns about an ongoing drought's impact on his crops. "It really didn't add up to much," said Lehman, president of the Iowa Farmers Union, "and most of the reports that I get from farmers around the state indicate that they are dry too." Even though Des Moines and much of Iowa has had several days of rain over the last 2 weeks, 64% of the state is considered abnormally dry or experiencing moderate or severe drought, according to the United States Department of Agriculture's weekly drought report. That report was released on Thursday. Iowa climatologists are unable to offer much hope that conditions will dramatically improve. "The outlook does not indicate that we will have an extended dry period, but things do not look like they are going to improve very much either." That according to Dennis Todi, director of the Midwest Climate Hub in Ames. "There's reason for concern," Todi said, "especially if large parts of Iowa fail to get rain going into June and the historically hot, dry months of July and August. That is also a critical period to determining the yield of Iowa's 23 million acres of corn and soybeans. Dryness gripped parts of the state beginning late last spring. The rainfall this month has done little to erase the deficits," that according to Justin Gillison, climatologist for the Iowa Department of Agriculture. "Mason City has received 7.2 inches of precipitation this year, 56% of the normal amount of 12.8 inches. Des Moines has recorded 8.3 inches, about 5 inches less than normal. Rainfall in parts of western Iowa has been 12 or 16 inches below average," Glissman said. "Dry conditions began in May and June of 2020. Even with a more active storm track, totals between 2 and 3 inches are not enough to put a dent in the long-term drought," Gilson said. Ted Corrigan, chief executive of Des Moines Water Works, said recent rain showers have reduced demand for water and helped improve levels in the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers, the drinking water sources that supply 500,000 central Iowa residents. "But it is not enough to solve the utility's drought concerns. The Raccoon River, for example, is at only about 25% of its normal level. Earlier this spring, it was at just 10% of its normal level." "We're still monitoring conditions," said Corrigan, who asked that residents use water wisely. Brett Swart, who grows corn and soybeans near Spencer in northwestern Iowa, said, "An inch and a half of rain 2 weeks ago and an inch on Thursday have helped." "They were a godsend," said Swart, who farms with his brother Steve. "All other precipitation has been pretty minimal and barely measurable," he said, but he added that the showers are definitely keeping his crop moving along. "We're living from paycheck to paycheck when it comes to moisture," Swart said. "Additional rain will be critical from about the middle of June through August as corn and soybean plants grow and temperatures rise. Those months are also when the plants go through reproduction cycles that determine how much they will yield. Iowa is the nation's largest grower and the second largest soybean producer." Todi said much of the rain in Iowa has been south of Interstate Highway 80. "Des Moines got measurable rain daily from May 14 to the 22nd, but the city never got more than half an inch on any one day during that stretch. Waterloo, Mason City, and Estherville also have had moderate rainfall, with only Mason City getting more than an inch on any one single day. Several northwestern Iowa counties have been stuck in the moderate drought since August. Thursday's drought report showed 37% of Iowa was in a moderate drought, or worse, a figure virtually unchanged from 1 week ago. Last year, Glisson said northeastern Iowa was the only part of the state that saw measurable surpluses of precipitation. The rest of the state was below average. Some parts of northeast Iowa have now precipitation deficits of 4 to 6 inches, he said. Tolley said a jet stream parked over or just south of Iowa kept moisture from the Gulf of Mexico from reaching Iowa. The last couple of weeks, that has finally broken down, he said. A dry spring is not all bad. Dry conditions early in the growing season can be good for row crops, Tolley said. Limited moisture levels will encourage deeper and more extensive root development as the plants try to access moisture, he said. That helps crops when they become more mature and need more water, he said. Farmers who have fewer disease problems get fewer disease problems when conditions are dry early, he said. In addition, the dry conditions helped in planting, Gilson said, and higher temperatures accompanied by May's light rains helped the emergence of corn and soybeans. Swart said his crops look good, but he worries about the weeks ahead. We're far from the finish line, he said. Even though northwest Iowa experienced drought conditions last year, he saw good yields because the crops benefited from existing subsoil moisture. This year, we don't have that luxury, he said, adding that subsoil moisture is about one-third of its average levels. We need rains to preserve our yields, he said, noting that his family's use of no-till and strip-till farming have helped to hold moisture in the soil. Otherwise, he said, we are at the mercy of Mother Nature. It is tough to tell if the conditions that brought rain to much of the state on Thursday will continue into the summer, Tolley said. A worrisome indicator is that there has been little severe weather this season. Tolley said most summertime precipitations occur during thunderstorms. Lack of severe weather equals dryness, Glisson said. We kind of saw that last year, mid-May into mid-June, when we started to dry out. The difference back then was we had near-capacity subsoil moisture. This time, we do not have that. Lehman, the almond farmer, said he and other growers would begin to feel better about their crop's future with a few big rains. We got a long ways to go, he said, and we have a lot of worrying to do. Our next story is written by Philip Sitter. Ames Community School District changing plans on remote learning options for next year. Some Ames students will still have a remote learning option in the fall, but not all students, and the option will look different than perhaps originally expected. The Ames Community School District has looked this spring at how to continue offering a remote campus option going forward for families who want that. The district had initially discussed an in-house option using district employees to staff such a program. The district announced Thursday, however, that remote campus students in grades 6 through 12 would be taught by Iowa licensed teachers through Edgenuity. I'm going to spell that Edgenuity. They would be taught through Enguity and not district staff. No specific reason for the decision was given in the announcement, but from the beginning, there had been concerns about teachers being overwhelmed by having to juggle teaching in-person students and remote learners, which many teachers already had to do during the COVID-19 pandemic. It had also been unclear whether a remote campus would be offered to elementary students at all in the 21-22 school year, but the district announced its decision on that Thursday as well. Due to low enrollment in the online option, we will no longer be offering remote campus at the elementary level, the district told families. At the Ames School Board meeting May 17th, Director Jamet Colton shared that a total of 39 elementary students were enrolled for remote campus, along with 31 high schoolers and 22 middle school students. In February, 126 families indicated on a district survey about the future of remote learning that they had a definite interest in going forward, while another 345 families may be interested. Those responses represented less than 25% of the district's registered students. Colton said the core subject classes taught by Enguity would align with state standards. However, the scope and the sequence might be different than for in-person learners. Students who need a course that is not offered through Enguity would come to campus for that class, she said. Having a budget-neutral remote campus program was also a priority for the district, but it was not immediately clear Thursday how the cost of using Ingenuity would compare to the previous in-house idea. It was also not immediately clear if the district was still going forward with its plans to seek state approval for its remote campus. State approval gives districts the ability to allow students from other districts to open enroll into their programs. Our next story is written by Daniel Gare. Ames celebrates completed redesign of a bridge between Campus Town and Iowa State University. Through rainy weather, the city of Ames celebrated the completion of the Welch Avenue construction that replaced more than a century-old infrastructure below and redesigned the streetscape above. City staff and Ames residents congregated at Ames Fire Station No. 2 at 11 o'clock in the morning on Thursday for the ribbon-cutting ceremony. Mayor John Hallier thanked business owners for their patience during the construction. That construction caused a complete closure of Welch Avenue for part of the process. Businesses in the area will be seeing more normalcy outside of road access as the project's completion coincides with continued vaccination distribution and mask mandates being lifted. Welch Avenue has served as a connection between Campus Town and Iowa State University, Hallier said on Thursday. It's both a bridge and a transition, and it was important to create an environment that met the needs and met the patience of so many different users. The challenges lay below Welch Avenue, Ames Municipal Engineer Tracy Peterson said on Thursday. They were outdated water and sanitary sewer systems, which needed to be replaced. While replacing infrastructure below, the city focused on pedestrian amenities and stormwater management above. It takes a team and a community to really do these projects, Peterson said. Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Michael Nagy spoke at the event, commending the stormwater management incorporated into the project to maintain water quality at Lake Laverne and College Creek. The Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship awarded Ames $100,000 for the project. Tree trenches along Welch Avenue offer natural beauty, as well as deep soil cells that will offer more space for tree growth and a water filtration system during rainfall. Nagy pointed out how fitting a rainy day was for this water management-focused project's ribbon cutting. He said the Welch Avenue project will serve as a great model for other cities to follow. I am so thrilled with what the result is, Nagy said on Thursday. Yes, we got the urban conservation practices that we were interested in, but what the city of Ames did and what folks in the town and the business get is a beautiful streetscape. Along with mindfulness of stormwater runoff, the redesign focused on creating a space for pedestrians as well as bikers. Two bike lanes were added on both sides of the road, and sidewalks were widened for those frequenting bars, restaurants, and coffee shops in that area. Waste bins, bike racks, and benches are still on their way, but the tree trenches intentionally serve as eating options along the avenue. Now we can send people right here to Welch Avenue to be able to show what we can get done, Nagy said. Our next story comes to us from Isabel Rosario. Trial delayed for a man charged with killing an Ames woman in her apartment. The trial of the man charged with first-degree murder in the death of Renee Bell, age 37, of Ames, has been delayed until later this fall. Richard G. Fleck, age 33, had been scheduled to stand trial June 15th at the Story County Courthouse. The court has rescheduled the trial to November 9th. Around 4:15 p.m. on February 20th, Kansas City, Missouri police received a report of a man hiding a trash bag in a drainage pipe, according to the criminal complaint. Officers said they found bloody items in the trash bag, some of which were identified as belonging to Miss Bell. Kansas City police alerted Ames police, who conducted a welfare check at Bell's apartment that evening and found her deceased. Flex was Bell's boyfriend and had been staying with her for about a month, Commander Jason Tuttle previously told the Tribune. Tuttle said Bell passed away or died from blunt force trauma injuries. After evading law enforcement for nearly a month, Fleck was arrested by Des Moines police, who were investigating an assault report on March 21st. The victim in that case suffered serious facial injuries, according to the police. Fleck is being hailed in Story County Jail on a $1 million cash bond. His pretrial conference is scheduled for November 1st. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press, the Dateline Washington, D.C. Congressional bargainers should reach a bipartisan deal on revamping policing procedures by early summer or abandon the effort. Republicans said on Wednesday, one day after George Floyd's family visited the White House and the Capitol to prod lawmakers to act. I think it's June or bust, that according to lead GOP bargainer Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. He said that on the day after the anniversary of Floyd's slaying at the hands of Minneapolis police. We've got 3 weeks in June to get this done, he said. I think if it's going to happen, it will happen before the July break, according to Senator Lindsey Graham, Scott's fellow South Carolina Republican and another negotiator. Neither senator explained why he targeted the next few weeks as pivotal in the talks that became serious in April, but have produced no tangible product. Historically, it gets harder for Congress to resolve controversial issues as an election year approaches, and each party seeks issues to use in upcoming campaigns. Republicans hope to win House and perhaps Senate control in the 2022 elections. I hope it's not being considered an ultimatum, said Hillary O. Shelton, Senior Vice President of the NAACP and Director of the organization's Washington office. I hope it's to push their fellow Republicans and say, let's take care of this. Floyd's killing triggered widespread racial justice demonstrations. Our next story also comes to us from the Associated Press. The dateline is Goma, Congo. Tens of thousands of people fled the city of Goma in eastern Congo, fearing another volcanic eruption by Mount Nyiragongo. I'm going to spell that Nyiragongo. That mountain spewed lava near the city last week. Traffic was jammed and pedestrians streamed through the streets, desperate to escape the impending danger. A new eruption could occur at any moment, the military governor of Congo's North Kivu province, Lieutenant General Constant Nidima Kongaba, announced on Thursday. He ordered the evacuation of 10 of the 18 neighborhoods in the city of nearly 2 million residents. Residents from many of the unlisted neighborhoods also fled after no warnings of Saturday's eruption left many in harm's way. The center of Goma, which was spared when the volcano erupted last week, is now under threat, with activity being reported near the urban area and Lake Kivu, Kongbanga said. Based on these scientific observations, we cannot currently rule out an eruption on land or under the lake, and this could happen with very little or no warning at all, he said. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. The dateline is Washington, D.C. The GOP offers a $928 billion infrastructure proposal. Republican senators outlined a $928 billion infrastructure proposal Thursday that would tap unused coronavirus aid, a counteroffer to President Joe Biden's more sweeping plan as the two sides struggle to negotiate a bipartisan compromise and remain far apart on how to pay for the measure. The Republican offer would increase spending by $91 billion on roads and bridges, $48 billion on water resources, and $25 billion on airports, according to a one-page summary released by the GOP negotiators. It also would provide for one-time increases in broadband investment at $65 billion and $22 billion on rail or train lines. Republicans have rejected Biden's proposal on corporate tax increases to pay for the new investments and instead want to shift unspent COVID-19 relief dollars to help cover the costs of the infrastructure plan. which is a non-starter for many Democrats. It's a serious effort to try to reach a bipartisan agreement, said Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. She is the lead GOP negotiator. The Republican senators and their offer delivers on core infrastructure investments that Biden has focused on as areas of potential bipartisan agreement. But their overall approach, up from an initial $568 billion bid, received a cool response from Democrats as well as the White House. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki made it clear the administration is concerned that the new proposal still provides no substantial new funds for critical job-creating needs, and it fails to spell out how Republicans would pay for the programs. We are worried that major cuts in COVID relief funds could imperil pending aid to small businesses, restaurants, rural hospitals, if we use this money to get back on they need to use this money to get back on their feet after the crush of the pandemic, Psaki said. As Biden left for an event in Ohio, he said he called Capito to thank her for the proposal, but he told her, "We have to finish this really soon." With about $257 billion in new spending, the GOP plan falls short of the more ambitious proposal outlined in the president's American Jobs Plan. In earlier negotiations, Biden reduced his costs from $2.3 trillion to $1.7 trillion. One White House official framed the argument Biden will make as whether Americans want to keep giving breaks to corporations or invest in modernizing infrastructure. The official spoke on condition of anonymity. Biden and Capito are expected to meet next week while Congress is on a break, Psaki said, and the White House is continuing to explore other proposals that we hope will emerge. A bipartisan group of lawmakers that includes Senator Mitt Romney, Republican from Utah, is also preparing an alternative plan. Investing in infrastructure is a top legislative priority for Biden. Talks are at a crossroads before a Memorial Day deadline to make progress towards a bipartisan deal. The White House is assessing whether the president can strike the contours of an agreement with Republicans or whether the president will try to go it alone with Democrats if no progress is made in the coming days. Our next story, also from the Associated Press, the dateline is San Jose, California. A gunman who killed 9 people at a California railroad yard fired 39 shots and appeared to target some of the victims, that according to a sheriff on Thursday. Santa Clara County Sheriff Laurie Smith said the shooter told at least one person, "I'm not going to shoot you," at a light rail facility for the Valley Transportation Authority in San Jose. He then shot other persons with 2 semi-automatic handguns on Wednesday. He killed himself as deputies closed into the rail yard, which served the county of more than 1 million people in Silicon Valley. More than 100 people were in the facility at the time. Investigators were serving search warrants on the gunman's home and cell telephone, seeking to determine what prompted the bloodshed, Smith said. She said he also appeared to have set a timer or a slow burn device to set his home on fire. The fire was reported just minutes after the first 911 calls came in from that rail facility. "I'm not sure we'll actually ever find the real motive, but we will piece it together as much as we can from the witnesses," the sheriff said in an interview. The attacker was identified as a 57-year-old person, Samuel Cassidy, according to 2 law enforcement officials who were not authorized to discuss the investigation publicly and spoke to the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity. His ex-wife said he had talked about killing people at work more than 10 years ago. "I never believed him, and it never happened until now," a tearful Cecilia Nelms said on Wednesday. She said he used to come home from work resentful and angry over what he, over what he perceived as an unfair set of assignments. "We could dwell on things, or he could dwell on things," she said. The two were married for about 10 years until a 2005 divorce filing, and she had not been in touch with Cassidy for about 13 years, Nelms said. Besides the 2 handguns, Cassidy had 11 loaded magazines, Smith said, A locker at the rail yard believed to be the gunman's contained materials for bombs, detonator cords, the precursors to an explosive device. That according to the sheriff. The death toll rose from 8 after officials confirmed the death late Wednesday of a 49-year-old person, Alex Ward Fritch, who had been hospitalized in critical condition after the attack. It was the 15th mass killing in the United States this year, all shootings that claim at least 4 lives each, for a total of 87 deaths, according to a database compiled by the Associated Press and Northeastern University. President Biden ordered flags to be flown at half-staff and urged Congress to act on legislation to curb gun violence. "Every life that is taken by a bullet pierces the soul of our nation," he said. "We can and we must do more." Governor Gavin Newsom spoke emotionally Wednesday about the country's latest mass killing. He said, "There's a numbness some of us are feeling about this. There is a sameness to this," he said. "It begs the damn question of what the hell is going on in the United States of America." Next up is the Nation and World Watch. First from St. Petersburg, Florida, vandals spray painted a swastika and the words "Jews are guilty" on a wall at the Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg, police said Thursday. Patrol officers spotted the graffiti at about 4 o'clock in the morning, the St. Petersburg Police Department said. The incident is being investigated as a hate crime, news outlets reported. City sanitation workers had painted over the graffiti by the middle of the morning on Thursday. Police are asking anyone with information about the incident at the Holocaust Museum to please contact them. Next, from Cairo, Egypt. Egypt has invited Israeli, Hamas, and the Palestinian Authority for separate talks aimed at consolidating the ceasefire that ended an 11-day war between Israel and the Gaza Strip's Hamas rulers. Israel's media and Egyptian intelligence officials said on Thursday. The talks would also focus on the reconstruction process in Gaza. "We are seeking a long-term truce that would enable further discussions and possibly direct talks," that according to Egyptian officials who spoke on condition of anonymity. That official said the talks could start next week. And from Toronto, Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Thursday made a formal apology for the internment of Italian Canadians during the Second World War after Italy declared war against Canada in 1940. Canada interned more than 600 people of Italian heritage, and they declared about 31,000 enemy aliens. Trudeau noted that the parents of Frank Accabucci, a former justice of Canada's Supreme Court, were among those labeled enemy aliens under a policy he said went against the values that Canada had gone to war to defend. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Pretty Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Gerald Jerry Stratton Ross, 70 years of age, from Ames, passed away Tuesday, May 25th. A visitation will be held Friday, May 28th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Stevens Memorial Chapel in Ames, with a prayer and time of sharing following. A visitation will take place on Saturday, May 29th, at 12 noon at St. Cecilia Catholic Church in Ames, followed by a funeral at 1 p.m. Burial will take place at 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, May 30th, at the St. Anne Cemetery in Vail, Iowa. Iowa State attire is strongly encouraged. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Michael J. Fox Foundation. For full obituary and expressions of sympathy, please visit StevensMemorialChapel.com. And here is the Story County COVID-19 update. The latest data from coronavirus numbers in Story County, as of 10 a.m. Thursday compared to 10 a.m. Wednesday, confirmed cases 10,681, which is an increase of 4, deaths 48, which represents no new increase, total number of people tested for the virus 167,875, total persons recovered who tested positive for the virus 10,423, The countywide 14-day average positivity rate is 3.4%. Next, we have an opinion piece. It is written by Jessica Hyland. She is the executive director of the Iowa Biotechnology Association. Over the past year, people throughout the state of Iowa have gradually worn their masks, engaged in social distancing, and weathered the storm that is COVID-19. Now that patience and dedication may finally be paying off. The pandemic might soon be coming to an end. According to the most recent data, new COVID-19 cases across the state of Iowa have declined to just over 400 each day, down from November 2020's high of well over 5,000. Iowa, it would seem, has the coronavirus on the ropes, and that's a reality we could not have hoped to achieve without America's biopharmaceutical companies. After all, they provided the crucial difference maker in the fight against the coronavirus. Currently, about 42% of Iowans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. These numbers tell quite a story. Not only did the biopharmaceutical industry succeed in perhaps the most ambitious medical undertaking in a generation, the research, development, and distribution of a brand new coronavirus vaccine, it did so in record time. For reference, vaccines take an average of about 10 or 15 years to develop, with the then fastest vaccine, measles, clocking in at just about 4 years. But rising to the occasion, the biopharmaceutical industry managed to develop multiple safe, effective COVID-19 vaccines in less than 1 year. If that's not a testament to the value of healthcare innovation, then nothing is. America owes a debt of gratitude to those hardworking individuals and businesses that made this breakthrough possible. Without them, we would not be on the brink of ending the pandemic once and for all. If there is one thing to learn from COVID-19, it's this. Our nation must support the future medical advancements by the biopharmaceutical industry. Given the outstanding results the industry has had thus far, one would think this lesson is all but self-evident. But that's apparently not the case, as our lawmakers are presently considering legislation that would do precisely the opposite. Recently, Congress reintroduced H.R. 3, a bill that seeks to impose a top-down system of government price controls over the cost of prescription drugs. Proponents of the bill argue that, in theory, this change would reduce healthcare costs, making the price of medication more affordable. But in reality, the legislation's price controls could threaten access to medicines and would rob the biopharmaceutical industry of the financial resources that it needs to sustain itself, leading to the development of fewer new medications and less access to care overall. Under H.R. 3, a draconian price control measure, America's biopharmaceutical companies are projected to lose approximately $100 billion in revenue each year, according to a recent study. That may initially appear to some members of Congress as money saved, but those misguided lawmakers are sorely mistaken. Financial losses of that magnitude are simply unsustainable. The biopharmaceutical industry would be forced to make drastic cuts to its investment in research and development of new medicines. That same report found that 61 new medicines would not make it to market should legislation like H.R. 3 become law. Effectively, H.R. 3 would stifle the future medical innovations that made breakthroughs like the COVID-19 vaccine possible in the first place. That is, undeniably, the wrong path forward. Proponents of the bill may believe they are cutting costs through the imposition of price controls, but in truth, they are merely sacrificing long-term healthcare progress for the illusion of short-term savings. Indeed, biopharmaceutical innovation has been the difference maker in the ongoing fight against the coronavirus. And if we want to continue our march towards victory, we must start by rejecting Bill H.R. 3. And here's the Dennis the Menace comic for today. Dennis and his family are just wrapping up dinner. Mom is clearing the dishes. Dad is sitting at the table drinking a cup of coffee. And Dennis is sitting in front of his plate, which it appears he's eaten his dinner. And Father says, "That dinner really hit the spot." That kind of makes Mom smile. And Dennis says, well, my spot still needs dessert. But here's the real life comic for today. Man and a woman are standing next to each other, and the woman has a fly swatter, and she takes the fly swatter and she whacks the man right in the face, right on top of his nose. And the man says, did you get it? And she says, get what? Our next story comes to us from USA Today. Fatal overdose is not just a white problem. Blacks, Latinos see the biggest spike in deaths. Health experts expected the pandemic to exacerbate addiction and substance abuse in the United States, but a recent study found Black and Latino communities were disproportionately affected by such disorders. Researchers from the University of California, Los Angeles, examined data from emergency medical service calls and compared overdose deaths in 2020 with deaths in prior years. They found overdose deaths seen by emergency medical workers increased by 42% in the United States in 2020, compared with 2018 and 2019, according to the study published Wednesday in the peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry. The largest spikes were seen among Blacks and Latinos, with 50% and 49% increases in overdose deaths during the pandemic, respectively. What's really novel in this study is that we have the first national evidence that Black and Latino communities were disproportionately affected by the pandemic. That, according to study lead author Joseph Friedman, he is a researcher and a student at UCLA. He said, this has a lot of implications of how the country likes to handle the overdose crisis. Researchers also broke down the data by region and found that while the Northeast had the most overdose deaths in the nation, as in previous years, states along the Pacific coast saw the largest increase during the pandemic, more than 63%. The study tracks with a recent CDC report published in February that looked at emergency department visits from December 30th, 2018 to October 10th, 2020, and they found weekly counts of all drug overdoses were up 45% higher in 2020 than in 2019. However, the data was not broken down by race and ethnicity, and it did not capture the entire pandemic, Friedman said. This lag in data availability can be harmful to vulnerable communities that need extra attention. There is a common portrayal of overdoses being a white problem, he said. It's really not true, and it's harmful because of awareness and also where overdose resources are spent. The study does not specify the drug used at the time of overdose because it can take months and sometimes years to collect such information from medical examiner data. But health experts speculate fentanyl may be the driving force behind overdose deaths. Dr. Jeremy Perron, director of the Center for Addiction Medicine and Policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, said she has seen an increase in overdose deaths in Black and Latino communities in Philadelphia with the increasing presence of fentanyl. It's not just heroin, she said. Fentanyl also is appearing in drugs that do not normally have as high an overdose rate, such as cocaine and methamphetamines. The potent drug can also be pressed into pills made to look like benzodiazepines. I'm going to spell that B-E-N-Z-O-D-I-A-Z-E-P-I-N-E-S. Benzodiazepines or other opioids and sold on the street. People who are using drugs intravenously are more aware of the high risk, she said. It's affecting Black and Latino communities differently because they are not as prepared. To combat the trend, Perron and her team have increased prevention efforts with naloxone training and education. Naloxone is a medication designed to rapidly reverse opioid overdose. Philadelphians also have access to walk-in treatment options where a patient can be given their first dose of methadone or suboxone at the emergency department instead of a clinic. Providers also encourage people to use special strips that test their drugs for hidden fentanyl, But interventions and resources do little good if there is no data to identify communities that need them the most. There is a lot of opportunity for education for people. There's a lack of understanding in many communities that there's really good treatments, Perron said. The surveillance aspect of this is really important, and this study emphasizes the need for better real-time data. Our next story comes to us from the Indianapolis Star. Will cicadas survive threats from climate change? Periodical cicadas date back to the time when humans split from the apes, according to researchers, making them more than 5 million years old. So it goes without saying that they have seen and survived changes to the climate and their habitat. But what about severe and rapid climate change, or sweeping and swift development and deforestation? Researchers are studying these questions in an effort to unlock the mystery that are periodical cicadas. They hope that this year's emergence of Brood X, one of the largest populations of periodic cicadas, expected to appear across 15 states for the first time in 17 years, will provide one more piece to the puzzle. One thing is clear, however, humanity poses a threat to these ancient red-eyed bugs and one of nature's most dependable delegates. As people have moved in, the cicadas are being forced out. Anything that threatens the forest will threaten cicadas, said Cliff Sadoff, a Purdue University researcher who studies cicadas. That could be climate change, it could be development. Either way, they are human-made issues. Periodical cicadas, some on 13-year cycles and others such as Brood X emerging every 17 years, spend the majority of their lives underground, sipping the sap of tree roots. This is different from their annual cousins, which are green and a bit smaller. They appear every year or so. The periodical critters make their above-ground clockwork-like debut for only a few weeks to mate before they die. Things kicked off in Tennessee and Georgia a couple of weeks ago, and they have just recently made their Midwestern debut. Their only evolutionary defense is their numbers. At sometimes more than a million cicadas per acre, predators can not possibly eat them all, meaning many will survive to reproduce. Still, they do not stand a chance when the trees that they rely on face harsher seasons or a saw table in terms of construction and development. In just the past century, cicadas have all but disappeared from certain historical breeding grounds as forests made way for development. Other groups of cicadas are emerging years earlier without protection in numbers, which many scientists attribute to warmer summers and harsher winters that disrupt the cicada's sense of timing. We have habitat preservation, which is the conservation issue, Sadoff said, and we've got climate change, which is the timing issue. The future of periodical cicadas hangs in the balance. Even though the various cicada broods populate pockets across nearly one-third of the continental United States, they claimed a far more vast territory before the arrival of European settlers. Hundreds of years ago, almost every acre of land buzzed with the insect's shrill chirp. Now, many places are silent. The range of cicadas that we see now is a fraction of what it would have been when the Native Americans were the only people around, said Martin Edwards, professor of biology at Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania. And that was before so many of our forests were cleared for farming and for wood. There's no secret to how that works. If the forests in which the cicadas are cut down, the cicadas themselves are doomed. Cicada nymphs are actually busy feeding the whole time they are underground, Edwards said. They're not just sleeping or inert. The roots of trees and plants have fluid flowing through them that cicadas sip out with a straw-like tongue, growing bigger over the years until it is their time to tunnel out. So if the trees are gone, Edwards said, they, cicadas, will go as well. But 17 years is a long time, and the world above is less patient. As trees are felled for roads and buildings, cicadas get trapped underground. That's what's been happening in Long Island, once New York State's last remaining stronghold and the country's easternmost domain for Brood X. And more than 30 years ago, the island's air vibrated with the deafening shrill of thousands of chirping cicadas. However, the population has declined over the decades and all but vanished during the brood's most recent 2004 emergence. One Long Island location where the insects once thrived is now silent of cicada chirps. Instead, it is replaced with the hum of car engines and occasional honking horns. That's because it's now a Walmart with a big parking lot. Chris Simon, a University of Connecticut professor who has studied cicadas for decades, told the New York Times. The coming weeks will reveal whether Long Island's population is still hanging on, but Simon told the Times she worries they are completely gone. Such changes are not exclusive to Long Island, Edward said. He points to other broods that have declined on Long Island, as well as in New Jersey and Massachusetts, falling victim to the toll of human activity. The issue is also a bit more subtle, and even cicadas that live near newly developed areas can suffer, according to John Cooley. He is an ecology and evolutionary biology professor at the University of Connecticut. He's also a colleague of Simon's. That's because cicadas depend on interconnected networks of forests to survive and thrive. If there is a break in the network, then cicadas are at risk of dipping below a threshold number, Cooley said. They rely on a high density to avoid being eaten by predators. If they do not have those numbers, then they will be vulnerable to hungry birds, squirrels, dogs, and other animals looking for a snack. Cooley said that the threshold number is a bit of an unknown, but it is a question researchers are trying to answer. He points to Raccoon Grove, an Illinois nature preserve that sits 40 miles southwest of Chicago. The preserve has a history of cicadas. Previous studies at this site served as the origin for estimates that dense areas of cicadas can have as many as 2 million per acre. Still, several decades later, less than a handful of chirping cicadas could be heard during the most recent emergence. Though Raccoon Grove, as a preserve, is a protected area, around it has been encroached on and developed, Cooley said. Now the patch is too small and too isolated from nearby wooded areas, and the population has died away. In that situation, it was not enough, he said. The vast number of cicadas lull people into a sense of complacency that make them think the critters are invulnerable. But that is not the case. Our next story comes to us from USA Today. Earth's temperature could edge past packed limits in 5 years. The odds of the planet continuing to warm over the next several years have increased, according to top meteorologists. In fact, within the next 5 years, there's now a 40% chance that Earth's annual average temperature will temporarily edge above a limit that was set by the Paris Climate Agreement. The report was prepared by scientists from the World Meteorological Organization, or WMO, which is an agency of the United Nations. These are more than just statistics, WMO Secretary General Petri Tsalalis said in a statement. Increasing temperatures mean more melting ice, higher sea levels, more heat waves, and other extreme weather, and greater impacts on food security, health, the environment, and sustainable development. The landmark 2015 Paris Climate Agreement set a target of keep warming to a few tenths of a degree warmer than now. Thursday's report said there is a 40% chance that at least one of the next 5 years will be 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than pre-industrial times, the more stringent of the two Paris goals. The chance of temporarily reaching 1.5 degrees has roughly doubled compared with last year's predictions, the WMO said. This study shows with a high level of scientific skill that we are getting measurably and inexorably closer to the lower target of the Paris Agreement on climate change, Tsalalis said. The Paris Agreement seeks to keep the rise in global temperature well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and to pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase even further to 1.5 degrees Celsius. National commitments to cut emissions, known as nationally determined contributions, fall far short of what is needed to achieve this target. The WMO forecast for the next several years also predicts a 90% chance that the world will set yet another record for the hottest year by the end of 2025, and that the Atlantic will continue to brew more potentially dangerous hurricanes than it used to. Our next story also comes to us from USA Today. The Galapagos tortoise was thought to be extinct. The search is on for a mate for a giant tortoise thought to be extinct 100 years ago. Earlier this week, scientists at the Yale University confirmed a giant female tortoise found in the Galapagos Islands was of a species last reported 112 years ago and thought to be lost forever, Galapagos Conservancy said in a news release. The tortoise was discovered on a Fernandina Island during a 2019 expedition of the Galapagos National Park Directorate and Galapagos Conservancy. Scientists identified the tortoise as the Fernandina giant tortoise, or the species Chelonandus fantasitis. One of the greatest mysteries in Galapagos has been the Fernandina Island giant tortoise. Rediscovering this lost species may have occurred just in the nick of time to save it, said Dr. James Gibbs, Vice President of Science and Conservation for the Galapagos Conservancy. Planning is underway for expeditions to find a male mate to save the species, so the tortoise does not meet the same fate as Lonesome George, a Pinta Island tortoise who died in 2012 without any offspring and was declared extinct. The Fernandina giant tortoise was believed to have become extinct because of volcanic eruptions in past centuries. The Galapagos Islands are home to many unique species of animals not found anywhere else in the world, and they were made famous by Charles Darwin, who visited the Galapagos in the 1830s. Our next story comes to us from USA Today. Vaccinated people can donate plasma to the Red Cross. A lack of blood drives amid the coronavirus pandemic has caused a blood plasma shortage across the country, but some have taken to social media to claim those vaccinated against COVID-19 are not eligible to donate. The claim follows similar posts that surfaced in the beginning of May, which falsely claimed the Japanese Red Cross Society stopped accepting blood donations from vaccinated individuals. The American Red Cross says you cannot donate blood plasma if you have the vaccine, because the vaccine wipes out the body's natural antibodies. That is how a May 22 Facebook post read. It got about 3,000 shares. Accompanying that text was a screen grab of a purported news broadcast with the title, Red Cross Needs Blood Donors, But Those Vaccinated Cannot Donate Plasma. Similar versions shared widely on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram contribute to debunked falsehoods surrounding the safety and efficacy of COVID-19 vaccines. None of the social media users returned USA Today's requests for comment. Donated plasma, the main component of blood containing water, nutrients, and proteins the body needs, is used for treating emergency burns and developing therapies for rare immune disorders. But vaccination status does not impact anyone's eligibility to donate plasma, and it also does not harm the immune system. That according to the American Red Cross and experts. Vaccines in general do not have the ability to override or do away with pre-existing antibodies. That according to Matthew Fryman. He's Associate Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. There is no precedence for a vaccine to wipe out antibodies made from infection with a pathogen, he told USA Today. Vaccination can certainly boost antibodies that are present from the infection, but only for the protein in the vaccine. This is not wiping out any other antibodies that are present. And the antibodies from vaccinated persons do not stay forever in the recipient receiving their blood or plasma. At least 1 or 2 months Freeman said. This short-term passive immunity is the scientific reasoning behind giving COVID-19 patients plasma for recovery and to prevent severe illness. But how clinically helpful it actually has been is uncertain. Historically, blood and blood product donations have been subjected to strict restrictions and deferral periods to guarantee no infections. Transmissible disease enters the national blood supply. These restrictions may apply to make donors who have had sex with other men, or MSM, female donors who have sex with an MSM person with piercings and tattoos, and people who have traveled to malaria endemic areas. Restrictions also apply to several other diseases, such as HIV/AIDS, anyone previously infected with the Ebola virus, or anyone with active tuberculosis. For those vaccinated, deferral periods can apply depending on the type of vaccine. Hepatitis B vaccine recipients have to wait 21 days after their shot before donating blood, and those vaccinated with the live shingles vaccine, which uses a weakened form of Vassarelia zoster virus, that's the virus that causes the illness, have a deferral period of up to 4 weeks with the American Red Cross. However, for anyone vaccinated with any of the COVID-19 shots authorized in the United States, namely Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, there are no deferral periods constraining blood or plasma donation. If the vaccine was received overseas or the brand is unknown, the wait time could then be 2 weeks, according to a joint statement released on April 16 by the American Association of Blood Banks and America's Blood Centers and the American Red Cross. Donors should be in a good state of health and symptom-free, said Katie Wilkes, spokesperson for the American Red Cross, in an email to USA Today. And at the same time of donation, the vaccinated person will be asked which type of shot they received, and they are also encouraged to bring their vaccination card, according to the April 16 statement. The Red Cross confirmed that it is accepting blood and plasma donations from people who have received COVID-19 vaccine and donors who do not have to wait to give blood after receiving the vaccine. Taking the COVID-19 vaccine does not hinder a person's other antibodies. And that brings us to the conclusion of reading the Ames Tribune for this Friday, May 28. Your reader today has been Dave Sauerman. Thank you for listening to IRIS.